I hope that as a guest here, some of the things I say will not seem too heretical about entitlement. Someone mentioned earlier that the previous panel was the most depressing he had ever attended, and I will make an attempt not to top that in terms of whatever heresies I have to say about entitlements. I'll take comfort in the old advice to speakers that not to worry if they walk out on you, it's when they walk toward you that you should be concerned, because what I have to say about the question of what to do about entitlements has something to do with what Robert mentioned Arthur Brooks had said, which is not so much to make wholly to make peace with them prudentially, but is to say that if entitlements are here to stay, to whatever degree is true prudentially, then we need to start thinking about how to make sense of them constitutionally. What would be the principles according to which some form of ameliorative government could be rendered constitutional? So let me begin with this tension, which is that within political practice, conservatism both abhors and accepts the entitlements regime. I don't mean by that that there's any sort of hypocrisy. I don't mean the idea that there are people in the establishment masquerading as conservatives who really are not. Rather, I mean simply that the basic premise that the government bears some responsibility, how much is another question that I'll address in a moment, for the material welfare of the populace stands more or less unchallenged in the mainstream of American politics. The disputes pertain to the terms and generosity of relief. So when, for example, Paul Ryan introduced his poverty plan last summer, he complained about the cost and complexity, but not the underlying commitments of the welfare system. Rather than dismantling the safety net, he spoke of, quote, repairing it. The goal, he declared, was, quote, to cure poverty and prevent it, close quote. His tactics for doing so included service providers who would help individuals formulate, quote, life plans. What I want to suggest today is that given the unlikelihood of a wholesale rolling back of this bipartisan consensus and the regime of entitlements it sustains, the alternatives on the one hand are to retreat into merely wringing our hands over the entitlements regime, or on the other, to constitutionalize it. That is, to attempt to bring it into closer accord with the values of the Philadelphia regime and to articulate the constitutional, not merely the prudential principles according to which conservatism is willing to provide economic relief. Indeed, it is not merely the policy arrangements, but also the constitutional arrangements of the entitlements regime that stand largely undisturbed. Wickard v. Filburn, for instance, is notorious among judicial conservatives, yet even the dissenters in NFIB v. Sebelius accused the Affordable Care Act of exceeding Wickard's framework. They did not question the framework itself. I want to argue that this persistent tension lies partly in a confusion of two separable elements of the New Deal regime, its administrative and its ameliorative premises. By its administrative premises, I mean roughly government that seeks to dictate the precise terms of economic life, especially by administrative fiat. By ameliorative government, I mean government that seeks to assure economic adequacy. Nothing about one inherently necessitates the other. That is, nothing about ameliorative government inherently necessitates administrative government. Now, let me be clear about what I am not saying. I am not suggesting caving to the New Deal wholly understood. Gordon Lloyd and David Davenport have a wonderful book about about Herbert Hoover's Burkean critique of the New Deal and about how it supplies much of the basis of contemporary conservatism. I don't need to highly recommend anyone in this audience. I do want to suggest that the most troubling constitutional aspects of the New Deal and its successors are administrative in nature. These are the concentrations of authority, the impositions of equality, or at least the attempted impositions of equality, and the interferences with liberty that so troubled Hoover. The New Deal's administrative premises deal with the regulatory authority over details of the economy that it and successor efforts concentrated in the executive branch of government. The ameliorative premises are social insurance programs that help protect individuals against the harsh edges of economic life. It was the administrative, more than the ameliorative premises of the New Deal that deranged the Philadelphia regime. By that I mean they altered not just its scope, but its character. by upending the two balances of power that Federalist 51 described as the dual protections of liberty in the American system, the horizontal division of power between branches of government and the vertical division between levels of government. By detaching them, rethinking ameliorative while jettisoning administrative governance, it might be possible to constitutionalize those contours of the entitlement state that command wide support. Indeed, this separation between administration and amelioration faced the New Deal itself. Historians, many of them, classify it into two New Deals. The first, typified by the Agricultural Adjustment Act, for example, the National Industrial Recovery Act, gave the executive branch extraordinary new, and the crucial point is hyper-detailed economic authority. The authority to set prices, taxes, and so on and so forth. These new regulatory powers fundamentally challenged the Philadelphia regime by combining legislative, executive, and judicial powers in the presidency, as we heard earlier, Federalist 47's very definition of tyranny. The second New Deal, originating in Roosevelt's 1935 State of the Union address, deferred to judicial and conservative resistance. It was more ameliorative in nature. It moved from what Walter Lippmann called a directed to a compensated economy, one based on the principle of social insurance. Roosevelt said in that address that individuals should be insured against what he called the hazards and vicissitudes of markets. Now, crucially for our constitutional understanding, the Second New Deal utilized the taxing and spending rather than the regulatory powers of the national government. The debate over those powers reaches at least back to Hamilton and Madison and to the question of whether Article 1, Section 8's power to tax in order to, quote, provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States constitutes a discrete power or whether it is limited by the enumeration of powers that follows. Hamilton argued that generality was the limitation on the spending power. Madison vehemently disagreed, insisting, for example, in his veto of the Internal Improvements Bill on his last day in office, that the general welfare could only be understood to encompass purposes subsequently enumerated. I will say, and I'll reiterate in just a moment, that my own sympathies here lie intellectually with Madison, but Hamilton would appear to be where we are. Justice Story's commentaries endorsed Hamilton's view, as a century later did the court, even when it was otherwise overturning the New Deal. The only limit on the taxing and spending power has long in American constitutional tradition been understood to be the requirement of generality. As we know, in the most notorious recent controversy, Chief Justice Roberts utilized this power to find the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act constitutional in NFIB v. Sebelius. Well, we're all familiar with the controversy over the interpretation of a penalty as a tax. What is striking is the lack of controversy over the description of the taxing power once he reached it. Put simply, the Chief Justice wrote, Congress may tax and spend. This grant gives the federal government considerable influence even in areas where it cannot directly regulate. Now, clearly there's room for reasonable debate between the Hamiltonian and Madison positions as a historical and intellectual matter. As I said, my own sympathies intellectually lay with Madison. But my disposition is Burkean. And it seems equally clear that the Hamiltonian reading is indisputably where we are in terms of sustained practice. So the question I want to ask is, would a Hamiltonian reading license some form, a restrained form, I'll argue, of ameliorative government? Put otherwise, does a regime of social insurance on the model to which Hayek refers in the Road to Serfdom, tax and spend, for the general rather than the particular welfare? Unquestionably, such a regime would have exceeded Hamilton's imagination, but social insurance is general insofar as it is provided according to standards subject to the rule of law rather than rent-seeking. Even those who do not receive financial benefits from these programs nonetheless benefit because social insurance is in place, is the idea. The knowledge that individuals are insured against the worst economic outcomes, the idea goes, gives or at least should give policymakers the confidence to step out of the way of more aggressive growth, gives individuals the confidence to take economic risks. It provides peace of mind in the same way other forms of insurance do. Again, there's ample room for disagreement here. The question constitutionally is this a general exercise of the taxing and spending authority rather than a particular one? The claim here is not that all programs with social insurance are prudent, still less, as Bill was suggesting, sustainable. It is merely to say that they are constitutionally compatible with a reasonable Hamiltonian regime of the General Welfare Clause, particularly if they are detached from the administrative premises that accompany them. But certain other premises are necessary if they are to comport more broadly with the tenor of the regime to which the framers agreed in Philadelphia in 1787. The first criterion a constitutional welfare state must meet, as authorities from Hamilton to Story to Roberts have already indicated, and as we have already seen, is generality. It must apply broadly, not to favored regions, groups, or individuals. It must be provided according to broadly available rules. This does not mean, again, that everyone must receive benefits. The point, rather, is that benefits should be provided according to the principle of social insurance and allotted by broad formulas rather than being negotiated or allocated ad hoc. Much of the ameliorative approach of the New Deal, which is not to say its administrative premises, could be understood to conform with generality. However, the national approach to economic relief shifted with Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, assuming a more ambitious and with it more detailed posture. Ted Lowy, who as many of you know we recently lost, thus described a deliberate rejection of the strategy of alleviating poverty in favor of an attempt to eliminate it. Poverty, he wrote, could have been alleviated merely by making the previous welfare system more generous, but he summarized the contrary disposition of the new poverty warriors with his characteristic writing. Alleviation, he wrote, was for sissies. The result, typified by the Community Action Program of the War on Poverty, was an army of social workers, federally financed political activists, and other interferences that hardly require an inventory in this room. Social insurance had been simple by comparison, and this simplicity is the next criterion an entitlements regime must meet to comport with the Constitution. By this I mean it must be minimal, not managerial. Hayek had said in The Road to Serfdom that it was perfectly permissible for a prosperous society to guarantee a minimum to every individual. It must but such a regime must aspire to adequacy, not equality, or to what Hayek correctly called that famous contradiction in terms, social justice. Federalist 10 seems to presume a relatively simple or transparent regime that can be controlled by ordinary political processes. This is implicit in the essay's claim that a minority faction, to which John McGinnis referred earlier, will be, quote, unable to execute and mask its violence under the forms of the Constitution. These groups will instead, Madison writes, be defeated by regular vote. But what he calls this Republican principle only operates if the public can exert basic control rooted in essential familiarity with the policies and processes of government. Excessively complicated and detailed programs turn positive government into uncontrollable government. It is consequently government's shrinkage in the size of what it discreetly undertakes, not its overall growth, that places it beyond the Republican controls the founders envisioned. The problem, in other words, is not simply government size. It certainly is government size, but not simply government size, but rather its complexity, which is a feature of administrative, not merely ameliorative government. Crucially, we don't need in this sense the common thesis that we hear, which is corruption, to explain minority factions. What we need is the breeding ground that the sort of haystack of complexity in government provides, in which these needles can hide. Finally, the Constitution's emphasis on federalism as a principle of liberty dictates a criterion of locality, what Catholic social teaching would later call subsidiarity, the ethical idea that a problem should be addressed by the closest competent social institution to the individual. Ameliorative government, as expressed through the mechanism of social insurance, more or less complies with these criteria, certainly a generality and simplicity, and there's no reason it cannot comply with locality too. However, if the foregoing analysis is persuasive, it also suggests the constitutional status of an entitlements regime depends on severing its administrative from its ameliorative premises. Put another way, the relevant issue is less the scope of government, which the ameliorative state expands, than the structure of government, which the administrative state derails. The founders provide a basis for such a distinction in Federalist 31. All observations founded upon the danger of usurpation, Hamilton writes, ought to be referred to the composition and structure of the government, not to the nature and extent of its powers. Hamilton does not mean there to undermine the enumeration of powers. What he means, rather, is that a government properly balanced internally that distributes powers between branches and levels of government rather than concentrating them can be trusted with those enumerated powers. This balance was the reason Federalist 84 could say the Constitution was itself a Bill of Rights. The administrative state is fundamentally hostile to the separation of powers, as it is to federalism, and it is consequently the combination of administrative and ameliorative government that threatens the Philadelphia regime. Thus far, this analysis has grounded a constitutional image of ameliorative government in a Hamiltonian reading of the General Welfare Clause. But by way of closing, let me say there's another foundation on which to erect it, which is Madison's theory of constitutional change. Explaining his 1815 decision to regard the Second Bank of the United States as constitutional after years of arguing the opposite, Madison elaborated a theory of measured constitutional change, what I've called a living constitution with a slow metabolism, whereby that which persistent generational majorities have regarded as constitutional through all three branches of government and ratified by the people must be regarded as such even by those who disagree. The time horizon to which Madison referred, over which the constitutional consensus he alleged had supposedly endured, was roughly a single generation. At least three generations have passed, more than a third of American constitutional history since the entitlements regime began, and arguably with far less ongoing disputation than the bank received. If persistent practice and understanding can render even a mistaken understanding of the founding constitutional, it would seem that moment has arrived with respect to the entitlements regime. It is here. That is not to say it should be expanded, certainly not casually or impulsively, especially for the reasons that Bill suggested, with the difficulty of removing the programs once formed. It is to say the regime itself, the notion of some public responsibility for material well-being, is unlikely to be rolled back in any wholesale sense, but its administrative and ameliorative premises can be separated, and the latter can be subjected to the principles of generality, simplicity, and locality. The task is less to conquer in that sense, but rather to constitutionalize ameliorative government. Thank you.